Page 25 for the requesting of Dhamma Teaching. Dhamma chaloka dipati sahampati katanjali adiwaramaya chata santi dasata parajakachatika tese tu dhammam anukampimam bhajan.
Yesterday we were talking about bowing. We mentioned bowing, and after the talk last night, you know, bowing is sort of a, is one of the many things about it. It's just a way of showing respect. And so after the talk last night, I walked out, and John kind of, you know, bowed his head kind of in a affectionately formal sign of respect. and so I bowed my head down, maybe just a little bit lower, and so then he bowed just a little bit lower, yeah, a bit lower, and so I bowed just a bit lower, and then he bowed like way down, bending at the waist way down. So then I crawled on the floor. I went way on the floor, stretched out like one of these Tibetan prostrations, all the way at his feet. And I couldn't believe it, but then he got down on the floor and stretched all the way flat, our heads kind of nearly touching. And then we started to giggle. And then Becca walked in. The other two of us lying on the floor and sprawled out head to head. And we couldn't even explain what we were doing.
Like, the story finally comes out.
Were you guys looking for our mouse? Or okay. All right. Back to the Dhamma talk. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namasami. These days, this age with things moving so quickly, with the speed of modern society, with the technological advances progressing so quickly, one of the more mental or emotional results of that karma tends to be an increase in fear, apprehension, stress, anxiety, and sometimes just exhaustion, you know, just getting really weary. Weary from the amount, or just weary from the barrage of information. So there's good reasons for apprehension, even though we have all this, and when things are so-called so advanced, it's good just to come back down to earth, really get down to earth, learn how to relax, learn how to relieve the tension. And getting down to earth is what being out in nature is all about. Literally, getting down to earth, living on the ground in a tent, sleeping close to the earth, doing walking meditation on the earth. Because no matter how much progress there is in the so-called world and society, you know, the simple basic facts of life, you know, are still always going to come back into play. They can't be denied. And so it's always good to just come back to sati, basic fact of life, sati. And one of the definitions of sati is to remember. Mindfulness is one way you can define it, but another aspect of sati is to remember, to recall, to remember the teachings, to remember at the moment what's a wise way to respond. Being quick enough with our mind that we're able to keep up with the speed of things happening externally, but mainly keep up with the speed of our own mind. The quicker our mind is, the higher, more highly educated our mind is, the more highly educated our defilements are, the more quickly our mind can move. So if you're able to multitask, then it means your mindfulness has to multitask too. And that sati is a kind of a reminder. So no matter what it is, no matter how fast it's moving, no matter what the emotion, no matter what the train of thought, a thought is just a thought. Just come back to this basic sati, remembering. A sight is just a sight. Hearing is just hearing. So these basic reflections or recollections of sati can be very useful in a wide variety of circumstances, like all circumstances. You know, if we see something that we don't like, if our sati is quick enough, we just remember, a sight is just a sight. It's like seeing is just seeing. And if we take it deeper, then we really see that it's not just a helpful reflection to stop us from starting an unwholesome train of thought, but it's really a whole insight into anatta. You've got the for seeing to happen. You've got an eye. You've got what seems to be an external object, but then you've got consciousness. And if one of those is missing, you don't have seeing. Seeing doesn't happen, and so you have to be paying attention to something with consciousness for seeing to actually occur. Otherwise, you literally don't see it. But in that process, that doesn't mean there is any being, any self, anyone who's actually doing the seeing. It's simply, you know, the body's working, the mind is working, the brain, the nervous system, everything is kind of functioning to allow seeing to happen, to allow hearing to happen. So that really simplifies life. No matter how complicated things are, seeing is just seeing. Hearing is just hearing, no matter what we hear. We hear someone give us praise. Oh, you're so wonderful, I love you so much. You're the meaning of my life. Sound is just sound. A few years later, the same person saying, you are such a jerk. Can't believe I ever loved you. You are a cruel, heartless monster. It's just a sound. Sound is just a sound. Impermanent, changes. And certainly with moods and emotions, right? I mean, when they come up, they can seem so real, like And if we can just catch ourselves, even just to remind ourselves and tap into what we really already know, is that, well, look, you know, this is a passing mental state, but just to remind ourselves with sati, that, you know, coming back, mood is just a mood. Yeah. Just a mood. And then somehow we don't go too far away from the yellow zone in the fun meter. And, you know, the yellow zone may seem like it's kind of bland. It's not, you know, like, whoopee, over here in the red zone. But it's not, it's definitely not in the blues. But there's a certain peace that comes from, oh yeah, been there, done that. I've seen this before. I've seen this emotion before. I've seen this reaction before. I don't have to fall for that. I've heard this before. I've heard people tell me this before. And it's like, yeah, it's fine. And then rather than life becoming dull, it's more like that the peace that comes from real equanimity is then closer at hand. So this is a very useful basic teaching. Sight is just a sight. Sound is just a sound. Whatever we sense, you know, with the body. Comfort, it's just comfort. Discomfort, it's just discomfort. One of the things which is a big part of life is food, and remembering that food is just food, or eating is just eating. I remember when I first started out going to Dhamma talks in a Zen tradition, the Japanese teacher I went to see, he was like, in a kind of typical, enigmatic, somewhat broken English way of explaining it. So eating eats eating. Eating eats Katagiri, his name. Food eats Katagiri. Well, I'm like... It's like... But, you know, he said it with such profundity. You knew there was some very deep meaning there. It's a eating eats eating. I really couldn't argue. Yeah. But as time goes by, actually start to recognize that, yeah, eating is just eating. But eating is a huge part of life. And for example, you know, when we really try to make eating into meditation, then there's so many different ways we can reflect upon it. But when it comes right down to it, no matter what food it is, it's just elements, right? You know, it's elements of solidity, fluidity, different tasting elements, all kind of mixed together, especially if you have one bowl and it's really mixed together. And whether it's, you know, your favorite or not your favorite, where does that come from? It's just elements, right? And the process of putting elements into our body, you know, what's that all about? Is it just another fun thing we do, or, you know, basically our body is just elements. Elements go in, elements go out. There's constant interchange. With every breath, elements come in, elements go out. you really make eating into meditation, a lot can be learned, because we tend to approach eating in the same way we approach life. Scarf it down without mindfulness, or obsessively keep everything separate and just eat this in a very meticulous way. We get very picky about, you know, certain types of food has to be just this right way, or what's considered healthy. I mean, food can get so complicated with all the dietary concerns, and this is healthy. Oh, don't eat that, and this is immoral, and this is genetically modified, and all of that, has a validity to it. But when it comes right down to it, eating is just eating. Food is just food. It's just elements, this interchange of elements. And that helps to simplify life. Otherwise, life can get so complicated. Sometimes too many concepts. Sometimes we think too much. Bowing is just bowing. We're talking about bowing and we can project a lot on bowing. Oh, it's a beautiful devotional act. Oh, it's kind of a weird Asian subservience. Oh, it's worshiping idols. Oh, it's... Who does he think he is? I'm not going to bow to him. What do we project on? But bowing is just bowing. It's just movement of the body. And like many things, we can make it into what we want. So if we're skillful, we look for ways to make ordinary things into something useful. So even if you just see bowing as bowing, then you're there with mindfulness. You can also see bowing as a way of an act of devotion to our highest aspirations. Now, we generally tend to bow to shrines with a Buddha image. Of course, the Buddha image is there just to represent what we would aspire towards in life, the qualities of the Buddha, the enlightenment of the Buddha, the wisdom, the purity of the Buddha. And especially in Asia, the head, or the highest part of the body, is considered the more sacred part of the body. And so lowering the head, voluntarily lowering the head, is a sign of showing respect. And lowering the head all the way to the floor in a bow is a sign showing a sign of great respect. It's like placing my ego at the feet of the shrine, or placing my respect, in recollection of my highest aspiration. So if we're able to do that each time we bow, even in some way, reflecting, what am I bowing to? What does the Buddha symbolize? And then that's a great way of constantly bringing up wholesome emotions, or coming back, keep affirming the direction of our life. Ajahn Chah would really encourage people to bow a lot, not just in the meditation hall, but going into one's hut. Every time we go into our hut, I'm encouraged to bow three times. And we leave the hut, bow three times. Come back in the hut, bow three times. Go out to urinate, bow three times. Come back in, you bow three times. And by the end of the day, we've probably bowed easily 100 times. through the morning chanting, the evening chanting, bowing to visiting monks coming, seeing your monks, you bow. At the mealtime, you bow. In the kuti, you bow. And at the least, bowing is just bowing. And fundamentally, bowing is just bowing. But as a way of bringing up a wholesome aspiration, it can do a lot to really plant seeds in consciousness. So, I encourage simple practice because, you know, it's easy to make everything complicated. You can make Buddhist practice very complicated. You can make meditation very complicated. But at least in life, even if you doubt, you know, you have a lot of doubt, you don't know which way to go, you don't know which thing to dedicate to, not even sure which type of meditation to follow. Anytime doubt or hesitation arises, at least you can come back to a practice like this. Seeing is just seeing. You're just being aware, sati, remembering. Remember this, right here. Seeing, this seeing. I'm seeing. There is seeing happening. Or watch that relationship between seeing and I am seeing. Right? How quickly the sense of possessiveness of that sensory experience creates a sense of self, right? I possess it. It's not just seeing, but I am seeing. It's my sight. It's my seeing. I am hearing. How it reinforces a sense of self. But if we can really get down closer and closer to the fundamentals of reality, closer to reality, it's just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, sensing with the body, impressions in the mind, then life's not so complicated. There was a story in the suttas. There's a story in the suttas that I've always enjoyed. It's in the... I came across this when I was still a very young monk, and ever since that time, I've really liked this story. It's called the Story of Bahiya, and a very simple teaching that the Buddha gave him. Bahiya was an ascetic in India. He wasn't a Buddhist ascetic, but you know, at that time there were many, many different traditions and sects and doing all different types of practices. And he was known as Bahiya of the bark cloth. As part of his living simply, he would wear cloth or clothes made of bark, which sounds pretty rough, you know, if you think of bark. Okay, I'll diverge for a minute, but not so long ago, even in Thailand, the forest monks knew how to make cloth from certain types of bark. Certain bark of certain types of trees, if you pounded it in a certain way, you'd actually get something which is like, you know, really rough cloth, which could then, you know, be sewn and worn. Ajahn Chah's successor, Lumpo Liam, and we first took him to our remote monastery on the Burmese border. It's totally, really remote, one of the most remote hermitages you find in Thailand. And he is an expert in natural medicine, knowing what plants will do what, and one of the last of the generation who really knows the forest. In a way, you know, and walking through the forest with him, he'd say, you know, if you mix the resin from that tree with the resin from that tree, you get like epoxy, you know, that's a really solid glue. And you know, that tree, you know, we used to take the bark and you describe this process of how to make it into kind of cloth-like substance, and then pointing out what different leaves and plants could be used for different illnesses. And that's a knowledge which is almost completely died out, but in the time of Ajahn Chah was very common, and the forest monks would rely on that knowledge of the forest lore for their medicine, for a lot of their needs. So this is Bahia of the bark cloth. And now Bahia was living in a ways away, kind of a remote location, a place called Suparaka in India. And it was there by the seashore. And he was respected as an ascetic, living a renunciant life, and people would give him donations and support him with bark. It's like, what do you give someone who you can't even offer them robes? You know, well, here's some bark. And he was living alone, apparently, and one day the thought came into his mind, I wonder if I'm enlightened. And usually that, it's very common that people living alone, practicing alone, or practicing without really good qualified teachers will start to wonder, I wonder if this is it. I wonder what level of enlightenment I've reached now. What level of insights? And it's just normal. The mind will tend towards overestimation of one's insight and wisdom, because compared to what we used to be like, seems a lot better. So he was there wondering if he's fully enlightened yet. And, am I an arhat or not? Am I an arhat, I wonder? And then a heavenly being called Devas heard that. And this Deva had a karmic connection with Bahia from a previous life. Apparently, according to the commentaries, in a previous time they were practicing together very intently. They were striving for enlightenment. There was a group of seven of them, and they all decided in a rather gung-ho fashion to climb to the top of a precipice with a ladder, where there's a little space on top, but sheer cliffs all around, and they would climb to the top, and then they kicked the ladder away, and they said, we're just going to practice here either until we are enlightened or we die. And very quickly, some of them became enlightened. One in particular gained the psychic power to be able to levitate and fly down to the village for alms food, which would be very helpful if you're staying on the top of a precipice without a ladder. But to, as an expression of their utter devotion to renunciation, some of the ones that didn't get enlightened or reach a very high stage of realization, one was Bahia, and he refused to eat the alms food that the other brought back. The other was willing to share. It wasn't like, oh, I've got alms food. I'm not going to share it with you. No, he was willing to share it, but Bahia, in his determination, said, no, I'm not going to eat the alms food. I'm going to keep practicing. If I don't reach enlightenment, then I'm willing to pass away. And he didn't reach enlightenment, and he passed away. Through that effort and determination, he had favorable rebirths. And one of the monks who had been practicing with him then was reborn as this Deva, and not fully enlightened, but I think had reached the stage of Anagami. But anyways, out of compassion for Bahia, watching over Bahia, was aware of the thought in Bahia's mind. Am I an arhat? Am I enlightened? Or what? And then the deva came down and said, quote, "You, Bahaya, are neither an arhat, nor have you entered the path to arhatship." So take that, you know, it's like, neither are you an arhat, nor, you're not even on the right path, buddy. Right? "You do not follow that practice whereby you could be an arhat, or enter the path to arhatship." So that was pretty much a complete rebuttal. Now, Bahia, he could have just denied it, said, "Oh, it's just voices." But to give him credit, he said, "Oh, well, if that's the case, then yes, well, then in the world, including the devas, where are there arhats who have entered the path to arhatship?" And the deva said, "There is, Bahaya, in a far country town called Sawati. There the Lord now lives, who is the arhat, the fully enlightened one. That Lord, Bahaya, is indeed an arhat, and he teaches the Dhamma for the realization of arhatship." And the deva revealed the location of where the Buddha was staying, at Sawati, which was one of the major monasteries where the Buddha stayed. And then Bahaya of the bark cloth, profoundly stirred by the words of that devata, then and there departed from where he was staying, stopping only for one night everywhere. Along the way, he traveled to Sawati, where the Buddha was staying in the Jetta wood at Anantabindika's monastery. Okay, so that shows that he had a tremendous amount of sincerity. You know, as soon as he realized that he wasn't enlightened, he wasn't even on the right path, and he found, you know, he heard of a teacher who was fully enlightened, then and there departed, and he was on his way. So he arrives at the monastery, and there are all these bhikkhus walking up and down, doing walking meditation, kind of similar to what we do around here, but probably a lot more of them. And you know, he asked the monks, "Where's the Blessed One? Where's the Lord Buddha? Yeah? Where's the Arhat? I want to go see the Enlightened One." And they said, "Well, the Buddha's currently on alms round. He's gone into the village on alms round." So Bahaya just immediately went into town, looking for the Buddha, looking up and down the streets, trying to follow the Buddha, find him. And so, entering the town of Sawati, he saw, you know, he was kind of like going through the streets, and then he saw the Buddha for the first time. And the sight, you know, is recorded as being very pleasing. You know, just seeing the Buddha was just so pleasing, lovely to see, with calm senses and a tranquil mind, attained to perfect poise and calm. Restrained, a perfect one, watchful with restrained senses. And on seeing the Lord, then the Buddha, then Bahaya went up and fell down with his head at the Buddha's feet and said, "Teach me the Dhamma, Buddha. Teach me the Dhamma so that it will be for my good and for my happiness for a long time." And so the Buddha's on alms round, and this man dressed in bark cloth throws himself at the Buddha's feet and said, "Please teach me the Dhamma." And the Buddha said, "No." Okay, that's the end of the story. The Buddha said, "This is not the proper time and place, Bahaya. We're on alms round." And Bahaya, to his credit, Bahaya said, "It's difficult to know for certain, Reverend Sir, how long the Lord will live or how long I shall live. Please teach me the Dhamma, Lord. Teach me the Dhamma, Sukhata, one who's well gone, so that it will be for my well-being and happiness for a long time." And for a second time, the Buddha said, "It is an unsuitable time, Bahaya. we have entered among the houses for alms food. And then a third time, Bahaya made that same request. And there's a tradition in India, if you ask for something three times, you cannot be refused. Of course, please don't try that with me.
That's what I
can't think. So then, after being requested three times, the Buddha said this. Then, Bahaya, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. To the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. For you, there will only be the seen in the seen, only the heard in the heard, only the sensed with reference to the sensed, and only the cognized to the cognized, then, Bahaya, there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here, nor yonder, nor between the two. Just this is the end of suffering. So, then Bahaya, through hearing this brief explanation of the Dhamma from the Blessed One, right then and there, he attained full enlightenment. His defilements were completely swept away. So he obviously had a lot of natural ability, what we call barami, a very deep sincerity. He was just very, very close. He just needed the right teaching. It was like his balloon was full. He just needed someone to pop it for him. And so right then and there, Bahaya became fully enlightened in the village. And the Buddha continued on alms round. And then when the Buddha was coming out of alms round, coming out of the city at the end of the alms round, then he saw that Bahaya had been killed by a mother cow with a calf. Mother animals, when they have young, can become aggressive and fearful. And so Bahaya was actually killed shortly after receiving that teaching. And when the Buddha saw this, he told his monks, pick up, make a simple litter and carry Bahaya back to the monastery, for he is one of your companions in the spiritual life. And so they did so, and he probably wondered, why makes a special effort, for this someone who just showed up out of the blue. And because when they took them back to the monastery, Buddha said, well, cremate him and make a stupa for him, which is a sign of great respect. And so the other monks were curious, why so much respect for this stranger who's only wearing bark. So they asked him at the end of the sutta, and as they were sitting there, the monks said to the Buddha, Bahaya's body has been cremated, Lord, and his memorial has been built. What is his destination? What is his future state? And the Buddha replied, Bhikkhus, Bahaya of the bark cloth was a wise man. He practiced according to the Dhamma and did not trouble me by disputing about the Dhamma. Bhikkhus, Bahaya of the bark cloth has attained final Nibbana, a full enlightenment. Which is an interesting statement. He said, he practiced according to Dhamma, and he didn't argue with me about the Dhamma. Obviously, probably there was some other people there who liked to argue with the Buddha or dispute. And then, on that occasion, it's recorded that the Buddha uttered this stanza, a poem, a Dhamma poem, where neither water nor yet earth, nor fire, nor air gain a foothold. There gleam no stars, no sun sheds light. There shines no moon, yet there is no darkness reign. When a sage, a Brahmin, has come to know this for himself through his own wisdom, then he is freed from form and formless, freed from pleasure and from pain. So, you don't have to wear bark to practice the teaching that Bhaya was given. And as it was useful and applicable then, it is still useful and applicable now. In the seen, it's just the seen. In the heard, it's just the heard. In everything that we sense, it's just a sensation. Everything that happens mentally, thoughts, moods, emotions, it's all there. But then when you come back to the world, and it's good always just to come back to these fundamental truths, and they always apply. They call Dhamma as timeless. It doesn't change over time. One of the, the things that doesn't change over time are these characteristics. Call three characteristics that things are constantly changing, and when things are constantly changing, they don't have the ability to fully satisfy because they're constantly changing. Once you try to hold on to something, then it's immediately gone. And when that's the case, it's impossible that there's actually a permanent self, something which is unchanging, an immutable, unchanging aspect of ourself. So this is good to remember coming back to the modern world as the teachings of the Dhamma are timeless or akaliko. The ways of the world are also timeless and akaliko. So no matter what the future brings, no matter no matter what's happening out there, it all seems to be quite similar. Hearts full of passion, jealousy, hate. For many things, it's just the same old story. I remember once, I'd go through periods of time in Thailand on retreat, not reading any newspapers, not hearing any news from the world, and then come back and after a period of time, see a newspaper, see a Newsweek, and the same old story. So the ways of the world don't really change. The ways of Dhamma don't really change. And they really go in different directions. Obviously in the world, we try to bring the Dhamma into our lives as much as possible in every aspect of our life. But what we referred to as the worldly or worldly aims and values are those things which bring us away from the Dhamma, pull us away from the Dhamma, are encouraging, are stimulating greed and desire, stimulating passions for this and that, stimulating irritation, all the things which encourage irritation and anxiety, stress, and depression. All the things which are encouraging to be selfish, and just to recognize that these are aspects of the world which are going in the opposite direction of the Dhamma. So you have to be very vigilant in the world. It goes true for all of us. So in many ways, it's, you know, it's always the same old story. The world will always welcome the great passions. But, you know, when it comes right down to it, if you can just come back to remembering sati. Sight is just a sight. Sound is just a sound. Sensed is just sensed. Cognized is just cognized. Right? That's all it is. And and then as time goes by, we gradually gain a certain freedom, bit by bit. And the passing of time is also something that the Buddha encouraged us to reflect on. You know, the process of aging, the preciousness of having the opportunity to practice when we do have this opportunity, and really making the most of it, because time keeps slipping away. Time's going by, and when we have these very special conditions, a huge number of causes and conditions are here to make it possible for us to practice in this way. And so make the most of it. It's a precious time. I offer this for your reflection.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.